Good morning, everybody. Thanks for coming here. My name is Dan Gilbert. As far as I can tell, there are really only two possible reasons to come here and talk entitled How to Do Precisely the Right Thing at All Possible Times. One is that you're naive enough to believe that the guy giving the talk is actually going to tell you how to do precisely the right thing at all possible times. And the second is that you didn't believe that for a minute, but you want to see how the guy giving the talk is going to squirm out of his promise to do so. Well, I've got a surprise for you. I am going to tell you how to do exactly the right thing at all possible times. And not only that, I'm not going to hold it till the end of the talk. I'm going to give it to you right away. I'm going to show it to you on the very next slide. And then if that's all you really came for, you can just get up and go home or go get some tacos at Taco Express. What I'm going to do then is spend the rest of the talk telling you why this marvelous gift I have given you in the first slide is something you won't use. That's what the talk today is about. Here it is. This is how to do precisely the right thing at all possible times. And this little equation was developed by two guys who were just chatting by their version of email in the 17th century, Blaise Pascal and Pierre Fermat. And they developed a little idea. Now, if this looks like Greek to you, it's because it's Greek. But here's what it says when you decode it. This little equation says that the happiness you can expect from anything you do is a function of two things. It's a function of the odds that what you do is going to pay off, the odds of getting a gain, and to the value of that gain. You multiply these two things together, and you know exactly how good your decision or your action is going to be. Now, just to make sure you understand what those two pieces mean, let me just run through a little example here. I'm going to play a little game with you. I'm going to flip a coin. If it comes up heads, I'm going to give you $10, but you have to pay $4 to play my game. Should you do it? Well, this equation tells you whether you should or shouldn't. It tells you that the odds of you winning my bet are one-half, they're 50%. The value of winning is $10, and hence the expected value or expected happiness is $5, and since you only had to pay $4 to play, that's a damn good bet. Now, because there are two parts to this equation, there are only two ways to screw it up. That's making an error in calculating odds or making an error in calculating value. What I want to talk to you today about are the kinds of errors people make in both of these things. This equation, if you could use it properly, could always tell you the right thing to do. But it turns out that human beings don't use it properly. They make two kinds of errors, errors in calculating odds and errors in calculating value. I'm going to show you what those errors are. Cool. Those drifting up towards the top. Okay. Let me talk a little bit about odds. You all know how to calculate odds already, right? The odds of pulling the ace of spades from the deck are 1 in 52, about 2%. Rolling a 2 with a die, it's 1 in 6, it's 17%. Flipping a heads, it's 1 in 2, it's 50%. So everybody here knows how to calculate odds. So if everybody here knows how to calculate odds, why is it that Americans spend more money on gambling every year? Did I say spend? Lose more money gambling every year than on all other forms of entertainment combined. There's a music and a film festival here this week and next. Americans will not spend as much money on music or film as they will spend in slot machines in Las Vegas. Clearly, it must be the case that either people cannot do division, everyone in this room was able to do it, but most people can't, or this isn't the way that people calculate odds, even though it's the way they should. How do people calculate odds? You know that as well as I do. If you're like me, you've had the experience of going to a grocery store, and you get in line, and you find that for some reason the line you joined is always the one that goes the slowest. And there's some guy in a big red hat next to you who's five people back in the other line, and he's out in his car, and you're still standing in your line, and you're wondering to yourself, how can I possibly always be the guy who chooses the longest line? And if you try to evade your fate by switching lines, then, of course, you know what happens. The line you were in suddenly speeds up, and the line you get into slows down. How can this happen so often? Because if it's really the case that I have some kind of bad karma or bad juju or some bad thing about me that makes the lines I join the slowest ones, then it would have to be the case that there's somebody out there who has good karma and good juju and says, you know, it's funny, every time I get in a line, it goes really fast. But nobody we know says that. Everybody thinks that they're the one whose line goes most slowly. How could that possibly be the case? Because standing in a line that's going really slowly is extremely memorable. It's not extremely common. But it turns out that the way people decide what's likely or common, what the odds of something are, is by how quickly and easily they can bring it to mind. And it's really easy to remember the times that you were standing in line and everybody else got out in the parking lot and you didn't. And because it's so easy, you overestimate how often it happens. Here's a couple of examples of that. Are there more pigs or dogs on leashes in Austin? Well, you know, you answer that question by saying dogs, of course. And yet, I mean, is there anybody here who actually spent the morning going and counting? Where did you get that answer? Well, you got that answer by trying to bring to mind instances of dogs and pigs on leashes in Austin. If you've ever spent any time in Austin, you can remember some dogs and you're scratching your head going, I'm not sure I've ever seen a pig on a leash. Because the dogs come quickly to mind, you assume they're more probable. Bravo! Your brain's done a good job. That's a wonderful heuristic. In fact, dogs on leashes are more probable, and that's why you can remember more of them. The problem is that how quickly something comes to mind isn't always a good example, always a good indicator of how likely it is. So here's a nice little word puzzle. Are there more four-letter English words with R in the third or the first place? How many people say third place? How many say first? How many say, he's a psychologist from Harvard, he's trying to trick me, I'm not going to vote? Good for you! It's a smart group. When you try to think of words with R in the first place, it isn't hard, is it? You go ring, rang, rung, and you could just do that all day. When you try to think of words with R in the third place, you go, well, bear, fort, park, and then you start getting slow and you're stumped, and it's hard to bring these words to mind. And so what most people say is that there are more words with R in the first place than R in the third place. But in fact, in English, there are many more R3s than R1s. Here's why this trick works. The way the lexicon in your brain is organized is like Webster's Dictionary. It's always easy to recall a word by its first letter. It's hard to recall any word by its third letter. It's hard to bring up R3 words, and as a result, we tend to think there aren't any. But in fact, there are many more than R1s. This has all sorts of comic and tragic effects in estimating things that are really important to you. For example, here are, sorry if you can't read this from behind, I'll narrate you through the slide. When people are asked to estimate how many people die by various means, for example, tornado, fireworks, asthma, and drowning, these are the estimates they give. You know, about 500 for tornado, about 160 for fireworks, 506 for asthma, 1,600 or so for drowning. Now, here's the reality. Here are the real statistics. By the way, this is per 200 million, of course, residents per year. Here's the actual truth. That was a great noise, but I don't know where it came from or why. Here are the actual statistics on deaths by these four delicious means of losing your life. Now, here's the things to notice. First of all, the two that are dramatic, tornadoes and fireworks, where things blow up and witches ride bicycles and houses fly through the air, are vastly overestimated. People think tornadoes and fireworks are remarkably dangerous, and they're remarkably not. On the other hand, people vastly underestimate the likelihood of dying by asthma or drowning. Why? Because when was the last time you picked up a newspaper and it said, person has asthma and dies? It's like, that's not interesting. That's not the front page of anybody's paper. That doesn't run on the news. But boy blows head off with bottle rocket on July 4th. That's, right? That's all over the media. So you can bring these instances to mind because they're vivid and they're well covered by the media. And as a result, you overestimate how likely they are to happen. Here's a Sesame Street game. Here are four things. Which one of them is not like the others? Correct. The swimming pool is not like the others because it's actually dangerous. Right? Plane crashes, terrorist attacks, earthquakes are extremely rare, but the likelihood of you or your children dying in a swimming pool is greater than the odds of all these things combined times 10. And yet, since they don't get any media coverage, you make the mistake of thinking that they are rare. Now, one of the best examples of calculating odds in this odd way is the lottery. If you know an economist, you know that economists like to say that lotteries are a stupidity tax. because economists correctly realize that your odds of getting money back when you give a dollar to the guy at the 7-Eleven and buy a lottery ticket are approximately the same as your odds of getting money back if you flush it directly down the toilet, except that you don't actually have to go to the 7-Eleven, right? The odds that you're going to flush and then millions will come out of the toilet are approximately the same as you're going to hand it to the guy with the paper hat and then Ed McMahon's going to call you later and give you a big check. The odds are indescribably small that you're going to win lotteries, and yet people play them. Why? Because people calculate odds, not like economists, but like people who use this heuristic. We see lots of lottery winners. Just Google lottery winner, and you on Google Pictures, you'll go through hundreds and hundreds of happy, smiling people with these giant checks, which, I don't know, I wonder how you cash a check that's this big. But these people with the giant door-sized checks, they're so excited, they're so happy, and whenever you have a Powerball, you see lots of them on TV. Here are the folks you don't see. You don't see the losers. You don't see interviews with the losers, right? You see interviews with winners. Now, I want to suggest to you, I actually calculated this, that if it were a law that everybody who won and lost the lottery had to have a brief TV interview, say 30 seconds with each winner and loser, you'd get 30 seconds of a guy going, "Oh my God, I won $10 million," and then you would spend 9.4 years without bathroom breaks or sleeping watching 30-second clips of people going, "I lost, I lost, I lost." Now, after 10 years, remember, the first 30 seconds of these 10 years were spent seeing a winner, and the rest of the 10 years, with your eyes pried open, were spent watching losers, and somebody said, "Okay, want to buy a lottery ticket?" You'd go, "No way, man. No way," because the losers would be as vivid for you as the winners. I can prove to you that the ease with which you can imagine winning and losing is the reason you do or don't buy lottery tickets. Here's a game. Here's a little lottery. There are 10 tickets in the lottery. 9 of them are sold to these 9 little individuals on the screen. It costs a dollar to buy a ticket, and if you win, you make 20 bucks. Should you buy a ticket? Well, let's go back to that little equation. It tells us that you have a 1/10 chance of winning $20. That's an expected value of 2. It's only costing a dollar to play. Sure, this is a good lottery. You should play. And in fact, people are very happy to enter this lottery. Now let me make one little change. Instead of these 9 tickets being owned by 9 individuals, let's imagine these 9 tickets are all owned by one guy named Fat Leroy. Fat Leroy owns 9 tickets. 1 is left. Would you like to buy it? People say, hell no. Now, it's not hard to see that the odds of winning in this lottery are the same regardless of who owns the other tickets. But in this case, it's really hard to imagine winning because it's so easy to imagine Fat Leroy winning. Right? You know, overwhelmingly, it's likely this guy's walking away with the prize. And so people say, I'm not going to play. He's got 9 of the tickets. And yet when you distribute those 9 tickets across individuals, people are really happy to play this lottery. This tendency to calculate odds by seeing how quickly and easily things come to mind can lead to all sorts of strange errors. For example, when people are asked, nobody in this room, we're talking about average Americans, of course, not the intelligentsia of the media class, but when most people are asked about the likelihood of getting mugged in Detroit or the likelihood of getting mugged in Michigan, they think it's more likely that they'll get mugged in Detroit. Now, let us slow down. Detroit being in Michigan cannot possibly have a higher likelihood of mugging than the whole state of Michigan. Why? Because when you think mugging in Detroit, pictures come to mind, right? You suddenly think Detroit's big city, dark corners, you know, people walking around in baggy clothes, they could mug me. Michigan, what comes to mind when you think of Michigan? I don't know, not much. I see a leg of purple thing on a map, right? It doesn't give you a mental image that makes it easy for you to answer this question. Here's another one. When people are asked the odds of dying of cancer or heart attack, they think they're higher than dying of natural causes. Okay, cancer and heart attack are natural causes. It can't be more likely that you'll die of cancer and heart attack than all possible natural causes. Here's a good one. It's much more likely that a California earthquake will kill 10,000 people in the next year than that there will be a U.S. disaster that kills 10,000 people in the next year. Why? California earthquake is a vivid picture. And the ease with which you can imagine California shaking and falling off into the Pacific Ocean dictates the likelihood that you're likely answering this question. The tendency to estimate odds by how quickly we can bring things to mind has another funny effect. Most of us spend most of our lives thinking a lot more about success than failure. Right? We're making plans. You want your film to go well. You want your date to go well. You want to buy a house. You want to succeed in your job. You're making plans on how to make things go right. So most of your mental time is spent contemplating how things will be when they go right. And you may take into account that things can go wrong, but unless you're a real pessimist, you don't spend a lot of time thinking about it. That means it's easier for you to imagine, through practice, things going right than things going wrong. That's why people are horribly over-optimistic about the odds that they will succeed in just about any human enterprise. For example, Americans think that they are more likely than average to have a gifted child, to live a very long life, to appear in the newspaper, to travel to Europe, to have a happy marriage, and to own their own home. Americans think they are less likely than average. This is the average American says, I'm less likely than average to have a drinking problem, to get a broken bone, to have gum disease, or to get in a car wreck, or to get a venereal disease, and I've spared you that slide. This tendency to overestimate the likelihood that good things are going to happen to us affects not only what we think what will happen, but when. Here's a well-known phenomenon you may have heard of. It's called the planning fallacy. This is a very nice example of it. I'll show you a little data from a study done at Harvard on students doing their senior thesis. Students are asked a couple of, maybe a month or two before the completion date of their thesis, before it's due, what's the worst-case prediction on how long it'll take you to finish the thesis? I mean, if everything goes wrong, your hard drive crashes, your advisor commits suicide, you know, everything goes pop, they say, well, then it'll take me about 48 weeks. How about the best-case prediction? Everything goes beautifully. Well, then it'll take me 27 weeks. Okay, how long will it really take you? 33 weeks. Now, look at this. Their real prediction of how long it will take them to finish the thesis is almost indistinguishable from the best-case prediction, and it's nowhere near as long as the worst-case prediction. They are incredibly optimistic about how quickly they will finish this task because they think about finishing it more often than they think about not. By the way, here's how long it really takes them to finish their thesis, 55 weeks. So, this is just a little taste of some of the kinds of problems that people have when they're trying to calculate the likelihood that something will happen. But calculating the likelihood that something will happen and calculating how much you'll like it if it does seem like a hard task and an easy task, right? Calculating odds is a little mathematical, it's a little tough, but knowing how much you're going to like something when you get it, well, that should be the easy part, shouldn't it? I'd like to suggest to you that it's actually harder. The hardest thing in this equation is to figure out how much you're going to like what you actually get. You think, gee, it might be hard to figure out whether I'm going to win a betting game with Dan Gilbert, but I sure know that if I get a banana cream pie as a reward, I'm going to enjoy it. I'm going to suggest to you for now and the remainder of the talk that that second claim has less likelihood of being right than the first. So let me talk a little bit about errors in value. Is this Big Mac worth $25? Now, I would imagine, I'm not going to call on you anymore because you're spoiled, right? You already admitted to me, he's trying to trick me, I'm not going to vote my conscience. But if you were like most people, you would say, no, hell no. A Big Mac can't be worth $25. And the way you know is you've never paid $25 for one before. That's not a Big Mac. Well, that's what McDonald's says a Big Mac looks like. We all know it's not what a Big Mac is. The guy's dreaming. Come on. Now, is this Big Mac worth $25? And you say no, and yet, have you ever had the experience, you get on a plane to, I don't know, Australia, and you've been locked in now, and you're 23 hours in the air, and the stewardess says, we will have peanuts, but not too many peanuts. And then the guy next to you opens up his bag, and suddenly the smell of the golden arches is wafting throughout the plane, and you're thinking, I should have gotten McDonald's before I got on the plane. You think, I wonder how much he would sell the Big Mac for. And you think, if he said $25, and you think, I'm stuck here for a day. This is the only food on the plane. Is $25 too much? Well, at least now it's starting to seem like a reasonable amount. Why? Because you are correctly asking yourself, what else can I do with $25? I'm here on a frigging airplane. You can't spend this money. The Big Mac's the only thing worth buying. That's exactly how one should answer the question, is it worth $25 to buy a Big Mac? There's only one way to answer that question as far as economists are concerned, and that's to say, what else can I do with $25? Now, in Austin, you can do many, many things that are better than buying a Big Mac, but on the airplane, you can't. That's the correct way to make this decision, but it's not the way that people do make this decision. rather than comparing with the possible, thinking about all the things they might do with their money, they tend to compare instead with the past. They tend to ask whether the Big Mac costs more or less than it used to. For example, on my way to work every morning, I stop at Starbucks and I pay $1.89 for a cup of coffee. Now, I don't know why it's $1.89. I don't know why it's $1.89 rather than $2.12 or $1.41 or any of the other numbers it could be. But I pay $1.89, and tomorrow if it's $1.92, I'll pay that. But if tomorrow it's $4.80, I'm going to start brewing my own coffee at home. Why? Is it because there's so many better things I can do with $4.80? That has nothing to do with it. It's because it used to cost $1.89. I'm comparing the price of the coffee now to the price it used to be and concluding I wouldn't possibly buy it. The reason you do this is because between your ears is a 3-pound meatloaf that is a change detector. The human brain does not detect stimuli, it detects changes in stimuli. This is why you can't smell yourself, and everyone else can. Because you have a constant odor of the body that you can't smell because it's not changing. Right? If you smell really bad and you jump in the shower and come out, you go, I smell different. And you do. It's the same thing with audition. If you hear a constant tone, if I were to play A440, in about 3 minutes you'd stop hearing it. You wouldn't be able to tell I was playing it. The constant hum of a refrigerator is like that, right? You can't detect a sound unless it's changing. The eye is like that. If you look at somebody's eyeball close up, you'll see that it's jiggling. It's jiggling around in its socket a little bit. Those are called saccades. Why is the eyeball designed to jiggle? The eyeball is designed to jiggle because the eyeball cannot see any image that stays still on its retina. It can only detect changes in light on the retina. So instead of looking at this little gum box, what's really happening is my eyeball's making the image of the gum box move like this so that I can see it. We know this because if you put a little contact lens projector on somebody's eye, we do this in psychology laboratories, little contact lens with a projector on it so that it puts an image on their retina that holds still. They see the thing you project, and after a few seconds, it disappears. They can't see it because their eye can't move around it. The brain is made to detect changes. We're very good at it, but this tendency to detect changes causes us to be irrational when we're judging value. We should care about price, not changes in price or the history of price, but that's not how it is it? These are some of the most magic words in all of marketing. Price cut. DVD was $19.99, now $14.44. What do you want to do when you see this? You want to buy it. You want to buy several. Not because $14.44 is the right amount to pay for a DVD, but because it changed from more to less. And the change from more to less makes me want to whip out my wallet and get things. When people are asked about two different jobs they could have, for example, one that is a 3-year gig and 1 year it pays $60,000, then $50,000, then $40,000, or a different gig where it starts with $35,000, goes up to $45,000, and then goes up to $55,000, they prefer the second job. That is, they prefer the job in which, over the long haul, they will make less money. Why? Because it has increasing wages, and it's nice to get a raise. It's really bad to get a pay cut. People care more about pay cuts than they care about pay. Here's another example of how this tendency to compare the cost of things or the value of things with their past cost or value can lead you astray. Imagine that you want to go on a Hawaiian vacation, and there's a travel agency near your house, and they have a $2,000 Hawaiian vacation package that's on sale for $1,600. Would you buy it? Well, when people are asked this question, by and large, they say yes. I'm going to change the question just a little bit. It's a $2,000 Hawaiian vacation package that's on sale for $700. You think it over for a week, and by the time you get to the ticket agency, the best fares are gone, and the package now will cost you $1,500. Would you buy it? Most people say no. Now compare these two. Okay? In one case, it was $2,000 and it went down to $1,600, and that seems like a good deal. In the other case, it was $2,000, it briefly went down to $700, and now it's $1,500, and people say no. They would rather have the more expensive vacation package that was never cheaper. In other words, we like a bad deal that used to be a horrible deal more than a good deal that used to be a great deal. Another example of the same phenomenon. See what your intuitions tell you about this. You're on your way to the theater. In your wallet, you have a ticket for which you paid $20, and you also have a $20 bill. When you arrive at the theater, you discover that somehow along the way, you've lost the ticket. Would you spend your remaining $20 on another ticket? Most people say no. They say, no, I lost my ticket. I feel like an idiot, but I'm not buying another one. Okay, fair enough. You're on your way to the theater. In your wallet, you have two $20 bills. When you arrive at the theater, you discover you've somehow lost one of the $20 bills. Would you spend your remaining $20 on a ticket? People say, yeah, why not? Of course. It's too bad I lost my $20, but that wouldn't stop me from going and seeing the show that I'd come all the way downtown to see. Now, let's just compare these situations. Okay? Each situation starts with, I have two Andrew Jacksons in my wallet. Now, in one case, there's an intermediary step where I change Andrew Jackson into a theater ticket, and then I lose it. And then there's a third step in which I have $20 in my wallet. And yet, at the end of these processes, which are logically identical in every way, and one time I go to the theater, and one time I don't, why? You all know the answer. When you lost the ticket, it feels like you're paying $40 for a $20 ticket. When you lost the $20 bill, it seems somehow irrelevant to the theater, and so you feel like an idiot, but a guy who still wants to go see the play. Finally, last example of this kind. You get free tickets to see a baseball game, but on the day of the game, you wake up with the flu. You know you'll feel bad if you stay in bed, but you're going to feel worse if you actually get up and go to the ballpark. Would you go? No way. People say, no way. I feel worse if I went to the ballpark than if I stay in bed. I'm staying in bed. That's the common answer. All right. You paid $500 for tickets to see a baseball game, but on the day of the game, you wake up with the flu. Same story. You're going to feel bad if you stay in bed. You're going to feel even worse if you go to the ballpark. What are you going to do? Most people say, I'm getting my ass out of bed and going to the ballpark. I paid $500 for those tickets. Now, again, examine the logic of these decisions. Two questions. Which do you usually like, feeling bad or feeling worse? Well, most people say of the two, feeling bad is the one I would choose. Okay. Which do you prefer, spending $500 and feeling bad or spending $500 and feeling worse? And people say, $500 and feeling worse. Right? I'm spending the money. I'm going to the ballpark. I don't care how bad I feel. It doesn't take a psychologist to point out to you the logical inconsistency of these two decisions, which are predicated entirely on your tendency to look backwards and compare the costs of something to its previous costs. So I've tried to make a case to you that people make mistakes when they compare the cost of things with the past instead of the possible. But it turns out that when we try to compare the costs of things with the possible, we make mistakes just as well. And they're all a very interesting variables. The Chinese philosopher Chuang Tzu said, if we say that a thing is great or small by its own standard of great and small, then there is nothing in all creation which is not great, nothing which is not small. Albert Einstein made the same point when he was asked by a reporter to explain the theory of relativity. Dr. Einstein, they say that only three people in the universe understand the theory of relativity. He said, no, I can explain it to you very easily. You know, when you're sitting on a hot stove for 1 minute, it seems like an hour, and you're sitting with a pretty girl for an hour, and it seems like a minute, that's relativity. Well, there's a little more, it turns out, to the theory of relativity than that, but that is the general idea, and it's the general idea captured, too, by this quote. That general idea is that context is everything. Comparison is everything. The quality or value of things is always gotten by comparing them to something else. For example, take a look at these two dots. If you were close enough, you would see they are exactly the same shade of gray in PowerPoint. And now let me give them slightly different backgrounds. Zoom. Suddenly the two dots look like they're different colors. One looks dark and one looks light. Only because your eye is inevitably comparing them to what's in their background. It's making the light one look darker and the dark one look lighter. By contrast, these things change color. The same is true of value. So, for example, I don't know how many of you are old enough to have remembered this election, but I remember this election. These two guys were running against each other, and I had a real strong opinion about who I liked better. I liked Bill. In fact, George Bush seemed to me like a pretty awful guy in comparison to this fine young governor from Arkansas. Now I look back. Now I look back and feel just a little bit differently. I think to myself, he was a nice guy, really. He's pretty moderate. That Willie Horton ad wasn't so bad. It's kind of funny. Yeah. Right? The value of things changes depending upon what you compare them to. Now, of course, retailers have known this forever, and they have used this knowledge to spare you the undue burden of money. For example, unscrupulous real estate agents will always take you to a broken-down crack house before they drive you to the house they really want to sell you. right? First, they say, oh, we're going to see a few things on our tour. Oh, here's the broken down crack house. This is in your price range. And your eyes widen and you go, oh, and then they bring you to a nice middle class neighborhood and you say, look, honey, no needles on the lawn. This place looks great. Because in contrast, it does. Haberdashers and other people who sell things of varying value know this too. That's why you will never find a haberdasher who tries to sell you the tie before the Armani suit. No, no, Armani suit first. Because once you paid $3,000 for a suit, $114 for a dumb little piece of silk to put around your neck seems like a bargain. In contrast, always sell the expensive thing before the cheap thing. So retailers and magicians and other people who want to take your money have known these tricks for a long, long time. But this tendency to compare things to each other and to make the wrong comparison can bedevil our ability to make good decisions. Here's an example. Imagine you had to make a reservation for an island vacation, and there are two islands. The first one has beautiful hotels, perfect beaches, no nightlife, and poor restaurants. The second one has a satisfactory hotel, average beaches, some nightlife, and decent restaurants. Where do you want to make a reservation? Well, most people are very quick to say they're going to make a reservation at the first island. But here's the funny thing. If you tell people, imagine you've got reservations on both islands, but time has come that you have to cancel one of them so you don't have to pay for both vacations. You've got to cancel one and you're going to go on the other. Where should you go? Most people say, I think I'll cancel that one. I'll cancel the one to the place with the beautiful hotel, the perfect beaches, and no nightlife and poor restaurants. Why? What would make people pick exactly the same island to make a reservation and to cancel the reservation? Here's the answer. When you're thinking about making a reservation, you are comparing the good things. You say, hey, one place has got beautiful hotels and perfect beaches. The other place has satisfactory hotels and average beaches. I think I'll go to the first island. On the other hand, when you're trying to cancel a reservation, you're thinking about what's wrong with the places. You're asking yourself, let me compare their negatives. And once again, the first island has the most negatives and the most positives. And that's what makes you both pick it and unpick it. You go to a wine store and you're trying to decide what bottle of wine to buy, what bottle of wine to bring to a dinner party. And if you're like most people, you don't want to buy the most expensive thing and you don't want to buy the least expensive thing. And so you kind of settle on something in the middle. That's why unscrupulous retailers will keep what they call aspirational items on the shelf. It's a nice word for stuff no one buys, but it makes the other stuff look cheaper by comparison. And indeed, studies show that if you put a really high-priced bottle of wine on a shelf, people tend not to buy it, but they tend to buy more expensive wine that sits right near it. Why is that a problem? I mean, it's really not a problem for retailers, is it? Why is that a problem for you? It's a problem for you because the comparisons you are making in the wine store are not the comparisons you're going to be making when you get home, right? I mean, when you buy a $33 bottle of wine and uncork it at home and pour a glass, you don't say, this is so good because it was sitting next to cheap wines when I bought it. Or, gosh, this tastes like crap because there was a $140 bottle on the shelf. The comparisons you make when you're shopping aren't the comparisons you make when you're consuming. And that's why making comparisons can lead you astray. Here's a nice example. You want to buy a car stereo. The dealer near your house sells it for $200, but if you drive across town, you can get it for $100. Would you drive across town to save 50%, that is $100? Most people say, you betcha. But imagine that you want to buy a car that has a stereo, and the dealer near your house has that car for $31,000. But if you drive across town, you can get it for $30,900. Would you drive to get 0.003% off the purchase price, thereby saving $100? And most people say, are you out of your mind? I'm going to schlep across town to save $100 on a car? Now, wait a minute. This drives economists crazy. Because what they will tell you is, when you save $100 and put it in your bank account, the $100 doesn't know where it came from. Right? Ben Franklin is not saying, well, I was saved on the purchase of a car, so I'm really utterly worthless. The guy was an idiot to drive across town to get me. But he's saying a different thing when it was on the purchase of the stereo. It doesn't matter what percentage off you're getting. What matters is how much absolute money you save. When you go to spend $100 on groceries, no one says, excuse me, sir, this isn't enough because you saved it on a big purchase. Right? So the comparison you're making when you're making the purchase isn't the comparison that you'll be making later on. Here's an experiment that demonstrates this in, I think, a very clever way, and I say this because it's an experiment I did. Subjects are brought into a laboratory, and they're asked a very simple question. They're asked to eat some potato chip. They're asked to predict how much they're going to like eating a couple of Lay's potato chips. Now, sometimes there's another object in the room, and the object is Godiva chocolate. And other times there's an object in the room, and it's Spam. Okay. When subjects are asked to predict how much they're going to like eating a potato chip, they say, predictably, that they will love the potato chip when the other item in the room is Spam, but that they won't like the potato chip nearly as much when the other item is chocolate. They're doing just what consumers do. They're comparing their chips to the other item and letting that comparison influence their prediction of how much they'll like the chips. We then say, okay, put the chips in your mouth, eat them, crunch them, swallow them. How much do you like them? There's the answer. And you all know that should happen, right? When you've got a mouthful of greasy, salty, fried potato chips, you are not thinking about the Spam that you might have had otherwise. You're thinking about all those flavors and sensations in your mouth. The comparison you make at the time isn't the comparison you make later. I guarantee you had an experience like this. You've traveled to France. You're in Paris. Everybody hates you when you try to speak French. They hate you more when you don't try to speak French. You're lonely and depressed, and what happens? You're standing in front of the Louvre one day, and you meet somebody from your hometown, some couple from your hometown you've never met before. They're wearing an I Love Iowa badge or whatever, and you get to start talking with them, and it's just so fabulous. They're so nice and warm. It's so nice to have somebody chatting with you in English, somebody who doesn't hate you, and you tour the rest of Paris together for several days. You have a wonderful time. You exchange phone numbers. You get home. You invite them over for dinner, and it turns out, what? Yes, in comparison to all your normal friends, they are really dull, boring, and stupid, right? It was only in comparison to the French people that they were so nice. Or you go shopping for a pair of speakers. These are, by the way, Audis Blues. I just bought a pair of these. These are very nice speakers. But you go shopping for speakers, and there's these beautiful little sleek ones that your wife likes a lot. Sorry, I'm being sexist, but my wife's sitting here. And these beautiful little sleek ones that match the furniture, and your wife or husband likes them a lot. And then there's these magnificent ones with these great sound that are hulking leviathans. These things, by the way, are my height. Okay? And they're as big as the dining room table. And you listen, you do an A-B test, and you go, ooh, yeah, ooh, no, ooh, yeah, ooh, no. And it's very clear that there's an edge to the big, ugly speakers. And so, like me, you buy them because they sound better. But better than what? Because when you get home, the speakers you didn't buy aren't still ringing in your ears. Indeed, within a week, the only comparison you're making is between what your living room used to look like and what it looks like now with these monster speakers in it. Once again, you've made a comparison at the time, point of purchase that you're not making later. Americans love variety, and this problem with comparison explains why they love variety and why it's a problem. Next time you're at the grocery store, examine the variety packs. Now, you would think that given that this variety pack of products probably has some of your favorites in it, but also some things you probably never really thought of buying, like the diet cheese whiz things, you should get a little bit of a discount for trying those extra products, right? But you don't. You pay more, right? This costs more than buying a dozen bags that are different costs more than buying a dozen bags that are the same. And people buy them. They love variety packs. And the reason you love a variety pack is you compare each thing to the other and you say, I like variety. So here's a test. You're going to come into my laboratory. You're going to come in every Monday for 4 weeks. And every time you come in, I'm going to feed you one of these chocolate bars. Now, you get to decide whether you want to have a Snickers, then a, what is that, a Cadbury Dairy Milk, then a Twix, and then a something orange cream, whether you just want Snickers every time. And this is what people choose, of course. That's the variety pack. They go, oh, you know, I'd like to try the different chocolate bars. That looks kind of good. Why does that one look so much better? Because you're comparing them to each other. The one on the left is boring, and the one on the right is exciting. But here's the problem. When you come into my laboratory the first week, in both conditions you get Snickers, so you score, because Snickers is everybody's favorite. In the second week, you come into my lab, and if you have Snickers, you score. If you have the other one, you don't. Why? Because Snickers is your favorite. The third week, it's, well, it's Snickers and Twix, and Snickers is everybody's favorite. The fourth week, of course, it's against the orange cream. Snickers is everybody's favorite. The truth is, when you run this experiment, people are much happier when they get their favorite every time. Hello, it's what favorite means. It's the one I will like more. Now, you go to the grocery store, and there's a big box of your favorite, and then there's another box with your favorite and some other crap you don't like as much, and you say, yeah, I think I'll take the one with the other crap I don't like as much, and I'll actually pay a little bit extra, because compared to each other, they're kind of exciting. Problem is, when you go to eat those bars, right, when you go and take the goldfish out, your tongue doesn't sense what else, the variety of things that are in the pantry. It doesn't matter. You just don't like goldfish, and yet you bought them. Variety has all sorts of other hidden costs in terms of consuming and enjoying. For example, a recent study on purchasing showed that people are 10 times more likely to buy jelly from a display of 6 jellies than a display of 24 jellies. Why? Because when you go into this store and you see all these jellies, at first you're quite attracted. You walk over and go, wow, look at all the jellies. And about a half hour a year later, you're going, I don't know, rutabaga, papaya, is that better than the cactus fruit, lime, mint? And after a while, you go, screw it. I don't want jelly. I don't need jelly. I'm going to save the jelly purchase for next week. This is too hard. Variety makes decision-making very difficult, and it often causes people not to make decisions. For example, a recent study done in Columbia University shows that for every 10 mutual funds employees are offered for their retirement accounts, participation in retirement accounts drops by 2%. Think about that. You're a member of a business and they're giving you retirement money and you can invest it in a certain number of mutual funds. And if they offer you 3, you'll pick one. If they offer you 40, you say, I think I'll turn down the free money and do this some other day. Doctors were recently asked, this should scare you because many of these things I've been talking about are consumers and you think, who cares? I'm a consumer, but they don't affect my life. Here's doctors making decisions about your lives. Physicians are asked, they're given a case study about a woman who's got osteoporosis, and they're told about a drug that is moderately effective in treating it. They're given a description of the case, a description of the drug, and they're asked if they would prescribe it. In fact, the majority of them do. Only 28% say, no, I think I'm not going to prescribe anything for this woman's condition. 71% of them say, yes, I will give her this drug. Another group of physicians is told about 2 drugs that are equally effective. They are identically effective in treating osteoporosis, and now 48% of them prescribe nothing. Think about that. Almost twice as many physicians decided that you didn't need any kind of treatment for your disease because they couldn't make up their minds which treatment you needed. God help you, if there were 9 drugs that could solve this problem, nobody would ever get them. Now, as hard as it is to compare alternatives to each other in space, 2 items on a shelf, it's even harder to compare them to each other over time. If I were to give you one of these, an $8 bottle of wine today, or a $51 bottle of wine on March 11, 2008, which would you choose? Well, data suggests that most people would choose the cheaper wine today, because people like stuff now. So here's a bet that's been given to thousands of college students over the years in economics and psychology laboratories, not a bet, but a choice. Would you rather have $50 now or $60 in a month? And college students go, ooh, $50 now. Okay? Now that might be rational. Maybe the pain of waiting a month isn't worth $10. But if it's not worth $10, then why do they do this? When you say, would you like $50 in a year or $60 in 13 months? They go, well, $60 in 13 months. As long as I'm going to wait a year, I might as well wait 13 months and get extra money. So people are very patient in the far future, but not very patient in the near future. Why does this happen? Once again, the problem is comparison. Here I've just drawn for you the very result I just told you about. What you see here, graphed here, is the subjective value. Think of that as how much I like it, how much I want it. The subjective value of $60 now is greater than the subjective value of $50 in a month. And yet, the subjective value of $50 in 12 months is smaller than the subjective value of $60 in 13 months. Those are the data that I just described to you, and these are just the same data in graphical form. Why does this happen? Here's why it happened. Look at these 2 characters. These 2 guys, a fireman and a fiddler. I think you will agree, one of them is taller than the other. And now, all that's going to happen is they're going to recede towards the horizon. Now, I want you to notice 2 things. First of all, the fireman will always be taller than the fiddler. At no point will the fiddler suddenly grow and look bigger than the fireman. But the difference in their heights is getting smaller and smaller and smaller until it vanishes completely. Now, let me graph those results for you. This is how tall a fireman and a fiddler look when they're 1 foot away, 21 feet away, 2,000 feet away, 2,021 feet away. Again, notice that the further away from you they are, the smaller they are. But they always retain their comparative heights. The fireman is always bigger than the fiddler. Now, all I'm going to do is drop some figures out of this picture. Interesting. Suddenly, when things are very, very close, the height of the fireman and the fiddler can change. That's exactly what you saw in the last slide. Here are some hypothetical data about how much you might value $50 and $60 at different points in time. You value the $50 now. You value $60 more than $50 at every point in time. That is, the purple bar is always higher than the yellow bar, but the difference between them is getting smaller. Let's drop some bars out. That's the problem with which we started. That's patience and impatience. And it occurs because of the kinds of comparisons you're making. When things are very close to you, you compare them differently than when they're far away. So, this is, I promised you at the very beginning of this talk, this is how to do precisely the right thing at all possible times. The problem is that this equation is useless. Because it's not an equation that human beings can put into practice. Why? I mean, I've spent an hour, in I hope a merry way, showing you the foibles and pitfalls of the human mind, how we make mistakes figuring out what's going to happen, how we make mistakes figuring out how much we're going to like it. We all kind of laugh and enjoy ourselves because we see ourselves falling for these little tricks, and we know that we and our neighbors and cousins and mothers all fall for them all the time. And yet, if we're so darn stupid, how do we manage to do things like get to the moon? We're not stupid. We're not stupid at all. What we are is ancient. We have a brain that was evolved over millions of years to solve special kinds of problems. Problems of how to find a mate in the short term, problems of how to find food in the short term. We are a species that spent its entire evolutionary history living in very small bands, never meeting anybody terribly different from ourselves. And our brain hasn't evolved very much in the last 1.5 million years, last 2 million years, really. And yet, the world in which we live has changed dramatically. This brain is trying to function in a world for which it was never made. A world filled with rocket ships and Fritos and wine purchases and people in France and all sorts of experiences that your brain was never supposed to have. And as a result, it makes mistakes when it tries to solve these kinds of very new problems. The solution is the kind of equation that Fermat and Pascal gave us. How did we get to the moon? We didn't get to the moon by going, I don't know, it looks kind of that far away. I think the moon's about the size of my thumb. We better make a really small ship. We got to the moon by science. We got to the moon by using equations that do a better job for us than our own intuitions. I'm trying to make a case for you here about the importance of decisions. Maybe making them in terms of Fritos and Snickers isn't the best way to do it, because Frito and Snicker decisions are only of very minor importance, aren't they? Decisions, though, are of major importance. Every species on this planet has to fear predators, has to fear nature, could become extinct through some sort of natural act of God. We are the only species on this planet, as far as we know, in the history of the universe, that has no natural predators, that need not fear the weather, earthquakes. They, by and large, don't get us. If we're not here in 1,000 years, it's for one reason only. It's because the stupidity of our own decisions. Our ability to decide what's likely to happen and how it's going to feel if it does. If that ability is corrupted, it's the one thing that might actually wipe us off this planet. If we're not here in 1,000 years, it's because we couldn't take advantage of a beautiful, simple idea, because we underestimated the odds of our future pains and overestimated the value of our future pleasures. I think I saw somebody saying something like, get the hell off the stage, so I'll stop there. Thank you very much.